For generations, women in the meat industry have worked for low pay in slaughterhouses or in other support positions. Now, a small but growing number of American women are taking charge in the meat business as owners. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge reports.
Let's start with the hog.
There's an elbow.
Carrie will
That's
take
an elbow?
The,
There's an elbow right that, here. And so I can't get my knife jump. Around it, so I'm cutting through it with
skin on.
My saw.
So,
Carrie Underley is slicing through half a hog as if it were an avocado until she hits a bone.
So what I'm doing now is I'm taking out the femur bone, and so that way, because the ham is a little bit of a drag, if you will, because we have to make money. Not everybody wants a big ham.
Underley is a fit 46-year-old master butcher from Chicago. Her father and grandmothers were butchers, and she put herself through college cutting meat. Now she runs a meat training company called Range Incorporated. She was recently in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, demonstrating to about 30 women how to slice and dice the tastiest and most profitable parts of a hog.
And you just want to be careful. There's the scapula bone right here. And we want to make sure we don't wreck it.
She's a knife welding rock star in her own right.
Tootie Jones was one of the women leaning in as Underley sawed, hacked, and sliced. Jones owns a cattle ranch in West Virginia.
And I think one thing Carrie's done is inspired a lot of people to go out, pick up a knife, learn how to handle a knife, and to go out and develop a business.
In addition to demonstrations like this, Underley organizes girls' meat camps. She says the meat industry is changing in a way that now allows room for women.
Meat production has always been a male job just because of the sheer size. And, you know, it's a physical job, you know, actually being able to lift these large animals. But as we're choosing to buy meat closer to home, we're looking for more craftsmen, if you will, to be the butcher so we can get them on every corner.
And that has opened up this avenue for not just the raising of the meat, but the selling, the marketing, the distribution.
Sarah Blacklin is director of NC Choices, a nonprofit in North Carolina that's trying to build more local meat supply chains.
I think it's a natural avenue for women to move into.
In North Carolina, the number of people raising and selling their own meat has gone from a few dozen a decade ago to more than 800 today. It's unclear how many are women, but one of those business people is Jennifer Curtis. Here in this chilly walk-in storage cooler in Durham, Curtis is checking on the meat that's come in that day. She's watching as fresh beef is tagged for distribution. Then she reaches down and picks up a thick chunk of dark red meat.
Oh my gosh, have you had this before? It's ossobuco or beef shank. It's right down there close to the ankle. It's got a lot of bone in, a lot of bone marrow. It's just fantastic for braising and stewing and beautiful flavor.
Curtis is the co-CEO of First Hand Foods, along with another woman. She got into the meat wholesale business 4 years ago after meeting too many farmers having trouble marketing their meat.
We also were meeting more and more chefs who wanted to get fresh local meat but couldn't get enough from an individual farmer. So we thought, I think there needs to be a business right here in the middle.
Curtis says 90% of the people that she works with are men. Farmers, processors, and chefs.
So we run into a lot of men, and it's taken some time for them to get used to the fact that we own this company and we're selling the meat, but it's been good.
She says it took a long time to build trust, especially among cattle ranchers in what she calls the old boy network. But Curtis says she proved to them she could get them top dollar for their product. And that's the bottom line. For NPR News, I'm Leonita Inge in Durham, North Carolina.
Every year, hundreds of hikers take on the grueling Pacific Crest Trail over the Sierra Nevada and Cascade Mountains. This adventure is not easy. The new movie Wild, which opened this past week, shows what the months-long journey can be like. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visited the trail last summer and talked to hikers who had finished the whole 2,650 miles of it. And she found that the only thing they talk about more than their aching feet is food. They have to carry it all, except when they get surprised by a little trail magic.
At a really beautiful but tough, steep patch of the Pacific Crest Trail near the Sonora Pass in California, a slight blonde woman in a cowboy hat carries a huge backpack. Her name is Shannon Pepper.
A.K.A. Pan from Missoula, Montana. Saying hard times. Ain't gonna rule my mind, sugar.
Pan's been hiking for more than 2 months.
When you're on trail and you're carrying all of your own meals, it can get really scary when you are close to being out. And I feel like I have a little better perspective on what it really means to be hungry. And you live in a society of plenty, and there isn't plenty when you have to carry all of it.
Your whole herd.
But plenty is what Pan finds when she walks into a picnic area where Hank Magnuski, trail name The Owl, has set up the Sonora Pass Cafe.
I'm The Owl. I'm your host here.
Oh, wonderful.
Help yourself.
Magnuski smiles as he brews up gourmet coffee on a portable stove.
Folks are doing 25 miles a day. It's like a marathon every single day for 6 months. And trail magic helps alleviate the pain.
Trail magic. That's any serendipitous help offered to hikers. Water or free rides or hiker-friendly food. Magnuski's actually a Silicon Valley engineer, but he's volunteered on a trail crew at the Sonora Pass for years. He realized how barren it is, even this picnic area.
There's nothing here but trees and a privy. The thought of a full-blown cafe in the middle of the wilderness just seemed like a neat idea.
So about a decade ago, he started setting up the Sonora Pass Cafe a few weekends each season. Today, Pan and other hikers with trail names like Gotta Walk, Pesky, and Laugh Track gather around.
Gotta do what you're told.
This is a crazy surprise. Yeah.
We have the classic, beautiful, like, fresh fruit.
He's got delicious beer.
There's a chocolate cake that you can't even imagine on the trail.
Also Wi-Fi. So currently I'm blogging.
Here comes the cookie.
Kat Addison, trail name Cat Dog, is from Bend, Oregon. She hasn't come down off the trail to rest or replenish her pack in 9 days.
When I got to the trailhead on the other side, I saw this little sign that there was trail magic. I started to cry because I was so tired. So I'm so glad to be here.
Addison's 62, and she's through hiking the trail for the first time.
The Sierras have kicked me around a little bit. I mean, I've had a couple meltdowns, a couple face plants. Didn't feel too good. People always say the trail provides, and sometimes it does.
Trail magic.
The trail magic.
Here's
to Hank's Sonora Cafe trail magic.
Hooray. Now, there's color in the cheeks and light in the eyes of the hikers as they throw on their packs and head out for a few more hours on the trail.
Congratulations on that 1,000 miles.
For NPR News, I'm Lisa Morehouse at the Sonora Pass.
And it's all downhill from there.
Perfect. To the Columbia River?
To the Columbia River, that's right.
Just over 2 weeks before Christmas, we have gift suggestions for the person who has everything.
Everything, that is, except a cookbook.
We're going to offer many holiday gift suggestions in the coming days, starting with cookbooks. Reviewer Susie Chang made some suggestions. And if the person you're shopping for is not much of a cook, that's just fine. Neither is Dana Cowan, who wrote one of the recommended books.
What's really charming about this book is that she starts out by confessing that she's not naturally a good cook herself.
She's editor of Food and Wine magazine. In Cowan's book, Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen, she gets help from big-name chefs.
Ming Tsai, April Bloomfield, Yotam Ottolenghi.
All of whom turn up in the author's kitchen to offer this kind of advice.
If you want to blanch your beans and shock them, take them out of the ice bath quickly so they don't get waterlogged. Or you can add some lemon juice to your caramel when you're making it so that the sugar melts more evenly. Or you can add a piece of pork belly skin to your stew, and that'll give it body.
So that's one cookbook recommendation. Another is the Banh Mi Handbook. Banh Mi is a style of Vietnamese sandwich and the one subject of this whole book.
But in fact, banh mi is not one, but many things. There are many different condiments, many different pickles, many different proteins, and this book tells you how to make them all, even the bread.
The simple-looking sandwiches are actually complex creations with many fillings and spices.
And if you like to experiment with spices or simply want to learn about seasoning, Chang recommends World Spice at Home.
There's a cornbread that's brought to life with a huge dose of cumin. And there's a glazed and broiled eggplant that's anointed with honey and Ras el Hanout, which has rose petals and grains of paradise in it. It's just some of the most romantic food.
Now, if you have friends who don't necessarily cook but do love prose, Chang says Apples of Uncommon Character is for them. It's not really a cookbook.
It's more a gorgeous series of portraits of what Rowan Jacobson, the author, calls the fruit most likely to be taken for granted.
There are just a few recipes featured in this one.
Chicken curry with apples and onions, or apple pakoras with mint chutney. I think Rowan Jacobson has a really good sense about how apples can play a role on the dinner table and not just as a snack you eat out of your hand.
Oh, great. Now I'm hungry.
Well, go ahead. Get something to eat, Steve. Listen, I can say this. You, listeners, can find a complete list of Susie Chang's cookbook gift ideas at npr.org.
If the word moonshine calls to your mind backwoods outlaws in Appalachia, get ready for a shock. Because now you highfalutin NPR listeners can get some artisanal hooch. Legal moonshine distilleries have been popping up around the country, and a moonshine renaissance may be underway. From WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, Andrew Yeager reports.
Alabama moonshine starts here. In this 80-gallon kettle in a horse barn in rural Bullock County, the man in charge is Jamie Ray.
This is where I'd steep the grain. I'll add a sack of rye to this. Fill it up in hot water. Let it steep for a couple hours, and it converts the grain to a simple beer.
Fermentation, some time to cook in the still, condensed to liquid, and you end up with a clear, unaged whiskey known as moonshine. Last year, Ray and a business partner started High Ridge Spirits, Alabama's only legal distillery.
Well, we started with the original white shine. It's 100 proof, and it's made with rye and sugar, which is the traditional recipe in this area.
Bullock County is known for illegal moonshine, and that's a nod to a backwoods heritage which has helped fuel a wave of small distilleries opening up around the country in recent years. Jamie Joyce wrote a new book on moonshine.
It has nostalgia to it. It's got a story attached to it, and it's so American in a way that it's really appealing to people right now.
It's a story of poor rural families subsisting on moonshine, particularly during the Great Depression, in the face of a big, mean government. Movies romanticized it. George Jones sung its praises.
He brewed white lightning till the sun went down, and then you'd fill him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, pappy's corn squeezing.
Shh, white lightning.
The song goes on to talk about a government agent hunting for a still, because even today, unless you have a license,
it is illegal. They are breaking the law, and then they have to be caught and punished.
Dean Argo is a spokesman for the Alabama Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Since the early days of the country, law enforcement has gone after illegal distillers since they don't pay taxes on their products. Argo says Alabama saw a surge in tips about illegal activity, so the board created a moonshine task force last year. These are six full-time agents, affectionately known as Still Team Six.
They will go out into the woods, they will walk those trails, and they will search until they find something or until they believe that the tip was erroneous.
Argo says in the first year, agents destroyed 27 stills. He doesn't expect the task force to end anytime soon. Meanwhile, the legal trade is trying to find new converts. At the J. Clyde, a pub in Birmingham, a bartender serves up High Ridge Spirits moonshine in a cocktail called the Alabama Honeymoon. He drops in some honey, pours in the moonshine, some lemon, shake it up, add ice, top it off with a bit of local craft beer, and serve. To find out what it's like, I recruited a willing taste tester.
I'm Sarah D'Elia, Andrew's colleague here in Birmingham. Whoa. That's really sweet and kind of sour, and the burning is there, but it's really indescribable. I mean, it's really unique.
This fancy $10 cocktail is infused not just with lemon, honey, and beer, but with fond nostalgia that's giving this traditional underground drink a whole new appeal. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Yeager.